somebody gave a call from the United States and asked for this talk this evening because they were concerned about things like global warming, concerned about the ecological damage to our planet, concerned about the future of their children. So tonight's talk will be the Buddhist idea of doomsday. Isn't that a wonderful idea, doomsday? Because those some religions, they really get into doomsday stuff. And the end of the world is nigh. And sometimes that people, if you look in the world in one way, my goodness, the end of the world is nigh. The signs are there. Things are going wrong. There are wars. There are pestilence. The sea is rising. Actually, we're quite looking forward to global warming in our monastery in Serpentine. Because we're up on a hill. When the sea rises, we'll have a seaside monastery. We'll live on the beach. Isn't that wonderful? This will be a resort. I've kept on calling our monastery in Serpentine Club Med. It really will be Club Med with its own beach. You know what Club Med means? Club meditation. So, we're not afraid of those sorts of things. Now, the important thing is that some people, they always think the worst things are going to happen. And that actually starts to bring up something very interesting in human psychology, which is actually all about like fear and guilt. Something terrible is going to happen, something terrible is going to happen. And one of the things that you know about fear and worry is that whatever you're afraid of, that is what usually happens to you. It's as if you bring it about through your fear and through your worry. The classic story which I tell, and I can't actually just stop myself telling it again because it's a great story. It was a time when I used to watch the television many, many years ago. And there was one series which I was absolutely addicted to. I'd watch it every week. And it was called Kung Fu. That was the only sort of almost spiritual program you could get on the TV in those days. It was over 30 years ago. And many of you may remember the series because there was this little fellow, a novice called Grasshopper, who was learning not just how to fight, but also learning some of the spiritual values of China at the time. Because apparently the people who learned Kung Fu came from the Shaolin Monastery, which was originally a Buddhist monastery. So they weren't just fighters, but they were also sort of monks as well. And I remember that because of that series, they always seemed to associate like Kung Fu martial arts with Buddhist monks. And certainly that helped me one time because I remember I was in London and visiting my mother early on. And I had to walk past this gang of like young people who are congregating out of one of what we call these days sink estates, these very poor housing estates which were rife with crime. And when I walked past them, they started trying to wire me up, starting Buddha, 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 Buddha. And I just went like this. And they left me out. I don't know anything about martial arts, but they don't know that. Just a recognition that there was a mug in brown robes. They didn't know what I knew or what I didn't know, so it's called bluff. I was going a long way with bluffing these days. But it helped me. But anyway, in this series, because they were associating Buddhist monks, Buddhist monks doing Kung Fu, I was also learning many things. And the episode which I remember, which comes to mind when I talk about just how fear actually makes the worst things happen, was a time a little grasshopper was taken into the back room of the temple complex. This was one of those rooms which were always kept locked, where little monks and even big monks were not allowed to go. There was all sorts of rumors amongst the young novices of what was inside that closed room. But now he was going to find out. His blind master took out a big key, opened the padlock, and let little Grasshopper into this very dark, this mysterious and terrifying room. And as little grasshopper became accustomed to the dark light, his blind master said, "What can you see, little grasshopper? What can you see?" And little grasshopper could see. He said, "Like a swimming pool. It's like an indoor swimming pool." And the master said, "That's not a swimming pool. That is a pool full of acid, concentrated, biting acid. Go close to the edge," said master, "but be careful. Go close to the edge and tell me what you see inside that acid pool." And little grasshopper very carefully walked to the edge, peered over. "Bones," said little grasshopper. "I see many bones." "Yes," said the master. "Those once belonged to little novices like you who fell in." "What else do you see?" And little grasshopper said, "I see a plank stretching from one edge of the pool to the other." "Ah, yes," said the master. "It is a training for all novices of this monastery, that one day they have to walk across that narrow plank, across the terrifying pool of acid. Are you ready?" "No, no." "I will give you 1 week," said the master. "1 week to practice, because in 7 days' time you will have to walk unaided across that pool of acid. And if you fall in, there will be just more bones in the bottom of that pool." And little grasshopper, you could see he was very scared. And I remembered as I was watching this movie, I was scared too. But then they took little grasshopper outside into the temple courtyard, where the monks had put another plank, exactly the same size and length, only just upon two bricks. And they said, "Grasshopper, you do not have to come to any chanting. You do not have to do any other services. All your duties are suspended for 7 days. All you need to do is to practice walking on this plank. But be careful, be diligent, because in 7 days, it won't be this plank in the courtyard you'll have to walk over. It'll be the plank over the pool of concentrated acid." So little grasshopper was practicing all day. He was so good at it, he could dance along that plank, do it blindfolded. It was so easy to balance, except when the seventh day came. And he was taken into the dark and mysterious and terrifying room. When he became accustomed to the dark light, the master said, "Get on the end of the plank." And you could see the little grasshopper did not want to go. He turned around and looked to his master in terror, as if to say, "Please, please don't make me do it." And the master said, "Walk." So grasshopper had to start walking. Now I think you'd understand. A plank over solid ground of the same size and length appears much narrower and longer when it's put over acid. That plank was just so narrow, and it was such a long way when it was over a pool of concentrated, dangerous acid. So little grasshopper started walking. And you can see he wasn't steady. You can see the fear was getting stronger the closer he went to the middle of the pool. But it was already too late. He passed the point of no return. He was already wobbling. And it looked like he was going to fall in. And at that point, we had the commercial break. We had the adverts. Oh, how I hated those commercial breaks, those adverts. I was so worried about what happened to the little grasshopper. So after the commercial breaks, we were back in that dark room, in a terrifying pool of acid, with a little grasshopper just a few steps back from where we ended up. He started to shake. He started to wobble. He started to sway. And then he fell in. And as soon as he fell in, the master could hear the splash, couldn't see him. and was laughing and laughing and laughing. And little grasshopper was trying frantically to get out. Until he realized, hey, this isn't biting, this isn't burning. It was only water. And they just put the bones in the bottom for special effects. They fooled grasshoppers, they fooled me. It was only water. And at that point, the master gave the object lesson, gave the meaning. He said, little grasshopper, why did you fall in? I'll tell you why you fell in. Fear pushed you in, little grasshopper. Only fear. If he'd have known that was only water, would he have fell in? If it was only water, he could have danced across that plank. It was the fear of falling in pushed him in. It was a great object lesson for him in his spiritual life, as it is for each one of us. How often is the things we fear the most, we actually make them happen. We bring them about. Fear creates what we're afraid of. Talking about the end of the world, I read this as a true story. It's quite a sick story, but it was reported in the newspapers. There was one fellow who used to walk up and down with one of these signs. Repent, the end of the world is nigh, the end of the world is nigh. He was right, because he walked across the road and got run over by a truck. For him, it was true, the end of the world was nigh. Because of his fear, he brought it about, probably. He wasn't sort of watching the trucks. No, it was reported in the newspaper. Anyway, what we're afraid of, that comes about a lot. So why is it when we look to the future, why is it we always look with such negativity? Think of all the things which could go wrong. Oh, it would be terrible if this happens, if that happens. No, when I was like in Thailand, that was a time when there was the Cold War was at its height. People were thinking a nuclear war was a certainty. That the Soviet Union, United States, especially when Mr. Reagan came to power, they were bound to actually to have a clash. We had all these movies about the end of the world. It never happened. In fact, good job, because there was enough people who weren't afraid, they didn't bring it about. A lot of time it's fear brings these things about. But sometimes you look, why is it that when we look at the future of the world, we always look with such negativity? And this is actually part of our human foibles, some defilements in the mind, why we're always so negative that we always look at the future and we think of everything which might go wrong. We never think of what might go right. And that's one of our problems in life. We're just so negative in the way we look at the past, look at the present, look at the future. Always seeing the problems, the faults. Now the reason is because as human beings we've been trained that way ever since we were at school. We were trained to look at the faults which are wrong and manage them, fix them up. We were great fixer-uppers of things and not appreciators of what's already been fixed up. Many years ago, I had to make a resolution. Every Monday morning, I would go for a walk around my monastery, but not to do any work. I was a manager of the monastery. A manager's job is to look at the faults and fix them up. And when I come over here to Nolamai on the weekend, my manager job, I've got to look at the faults and fix them up. Always fixing up people's faults. They come here and tell me their problems. No one ever comes here and tells me all the wonderful things happening to them. They never come and say, oh, I had a wonderful day. I've got such a wonderful husband. All my children are so good. I've got no problems in the world. I'm very wealthy. I'm just so healthy. They never tell me that. They come and say, oh, I got cancer, I'm dying, my husband is just going out with somebody else, my children aren't studying, they're talking back to me, they're on drugs, blah, blah, blah. Oh, come on, be kind to your poor monk. But it's because we get trained ever since we were at school, we're always given problems, things which are wrong, and told to fix them. And our whole life becomes fixing problems. Fixing the problem in ourselves, whatever that is. Fixing the problem in our husband. Fixing that problem in our wife. Fixing the problem with our kids. They're never good enough. Fixing the problem with our parents. Fixing the problem with the government. Fixing the problem with the world. We're all great fixers. That's why we're in a fix. A We are. We need to be fixed. So I'm going to fix you now. Ajahn Chah gave this beautiful story once. He said, it's like a woman who is raising chickens. And every morning, she goes into the chicken pen and she collects all the chicken shit. And she leaves all the eggs. Every day, all she ever collects is chicken shit. What a stupid woman that is. Now, don't you get the meaning of that story? Why is it when we go into the future, all we collect is the shit, the chicken shit? The rotten stuff, the dung, the terrible stuff. If we were raising chicken, collect the eggs, for goodness sake. You can use them, they're good. You can sell them, you can make omelettes or whatever else you want to do with eggs, make nice cakes. Now, if you're going to go into the future and collect things, why don't you collect the eggs, the good stuff? Why don't you think of all the wonderful things which might happen? Instead of thinking of all the rotten things which are happening. Do you see what I mean, how we're negative? We only, whatever we do in life, we only collect the problems. We never see the good things which are going on. We look at our husband, you just collect the chicken dung. That's all you collect, you wives. You never appreciate the man, all the beautiful eggs he's got there, all the wonderful things which he's done for you, how hard he's worked, his beautiful character. You look at your kids, they're trying so hard, wonderful eggs they're laying, and you're not working hard enough. You come second, you should come top. Come on, you should go to university. Poor old kids. Half the kids at school have to be lower than average. Have to be. But you want your kid to be better than average. And that's our problem. They can't be. So when you... This is what I did. So I decided every Monday morning, instead of collecting the chicken shit from my monastery, I collect the eggs. What that meant for me, I deliberately not look at what needed to be fixed up, not look at all the mistakes, not look at all the letters which needed to be written, but looked at all the letters I had written. Looked at all of the beautiful buildings which had been built. Look at all of the things which didn't need to be swept. Look at all the things which were beautiful and perfect in my monastery. Instead of just looking at this is wrong, I have to tell that monk to do this, they should do this, wherever. Instead of actually looking at the faults, I deliberately went there to look at the beauty. Because you know what? People would visit my monastery and say, oh, isn't it a wonderful monastery? Isn't it a beautiful monastery? I couldn't see it. When I went to my monastery, all I could see is this monk was misbehaving, that gutter needed to be cleaned out, that was cracked, this needed to be fixed up, that needed to be done. Because I was a manager, all you see is the faults. So I had to stop being the manager, the fault finder. I had to look at what was really there. I had to see the monastery just as other people see the monastery. Just like you have to see your wife just as other people see your wife. Not as you see the wife. You know what a wonderful woman that is. They've got so many friends, but you know, you can't see it. You always have to fix this and fix that, and you're the manager. Now I think you get the point of what I'm saying here. By doing that little training, I learned how to appreciate my monastery once again. And not just appreciate my monastery, to appreciate life again. Because too often in our life, we just see everything which is wrong. We're just collecting the chicken dung again, never collecting the eggs. You look at yourself, and what do you see? All the things which are wrong in you. Oh, I should be doing this, I should be doing that, I should be a better meditator, or I should be giving better talks, I shouldn't be telling the same old stories all over again, I shouldn't be telling the same old jokes, I shouldn't be doing this, I shouldn't be talking too much. How many times we look at ourselves and we always just pick out the faults, picking out the chicken dung? How many times in us do we see the beautiful things in ourselves? The beautiful things in our partner, the beautiful things in our children, the beautiful things in our life. One morning a week you should do that at least. See all the wonderful things in your kids. See the beauty in your parents. See the amazing success you've had in your life. To appreciate what you have. And then you can see just how beautiful you are and your life is. If you can do that now, you get a bit of happiness. You're not sort of being overly optimistic, because the rest of the day you're seeing the faults. But at least in that one morning a week, you're giving yourself a break and getting some sort of perspective on life. If you can do that in a day, then you can do that in the future. look upon the future, and instead of thinking all the things which might possibly go wrong, you start to think of all the things which might possibly go right. Because when we're doomsday people, all we think is all the terrible things which are going to go wrong. I know it's going to be global warming. I know just, you know, the whole world is going to end. I know that, you know, the oil prices are going to go up. There's not enough oil left. So, we, you know, all the price of oil, the water will run out. We won't be able to do this. We won't be able to do that. The world is going to be a terrible state. Our kids are sort of going to go berserk. Law and order, things are getting worse and worse and worse. It's not the same as when I was young. Have a look what it was like when you were young. Whenever any parents come here to complain about their kids, my standard response is, well, what did you do when you were that age? This is your karmic result. Because you didn't do what your parents said, now this is what you have to endure. It's obvious. Karma, that's all. It's just your kids are getting your own back, that's all. It's true. And it's amazing just how it works every time. If anyone's a counsellor, that's a great strategy. And this is karma, this is what you expect. So look, why is it we always see the worst of what's going to happen in the future? Of course it might happen, but the point is with life, we look in the positive side of life, and looking at the positive side, there's more chance that the positive will actually come about. If we look at the negative side, there's more chance the negative will come out. It's a psychology of wish fulfillment. It's like watering the flowers or watering the weeds. What do you want to grow in your garden? You water the flowers, you'll find that flowers will grow. You water the weeds, you'll find the weeds will grow. If you water positive energy, positive thinking, positive comments, you'll understand that the positive will grow in you. You water the positive in your partner, praising them, seeing their good qualities, you will see those good qualities grow and grow and grow. The mind is a forerunner of all things. The mind makes the world, not the world makes the mind. If you know how to use the mind, it's amazing just how you can change your world, the way you look at it. And therefore, with that positive attitude, it's amazing what you can do. Okay, so what? There's global warming. You can make use of that. The wise person is one who can adapt to time and place. The one who realizes it's not the world which is the problem. It's the way we respond to it, the way we relate to it. We can't change the way of the world, but we can change the way we relate to it, with the way we respond to it. That's how we can work as Buddhists, or as people. So whatever happens in the world, we can always find something, some way of turning it to our advantage, to happiness, to peace, to harmony, or whatever. You know, in the Vietnam War in Southeast Asia, the Americans dropped so many bombs on those countries. There were lots of bomb casings left. When I was a young monk, you go from monastery to monastery, and all those bomb casings were used as monastery bells. They all came because that was the best iron they could get. They gathered them up from the jungles or whatever, the casings, and they just welded a little hook on the top, and that was your monastery bell. It's amazing just how you can turn a bomb into a monastery bell. They took the explosive off before they hit the bell first of all. And that didn't really woken the monks up in the morning. So this is just an idea of what we can actually do with even bad things. Whatever happens in life, you can always make use of it. You get these sicknesses, you get these deaths. Whatever happens to you, you can always make use of it. So, the famous saying, a Chinese saying, if this is all you get from this talk this evening, this will change your life. Rather light a candle than complain about darkness. I read that so many years ago, and that has actually affected my life enormously. Instead of complaining about things, go and do something. Complaining doesn't help. Rather light a candle than complain about darkness. So if something's happening, you can always do something about it. I've had a long enough life now to know whatever happens in this world, if there's a war, if there's a conflagration, if the sea rises, if there's tornadoes, if there's hailstones, whatever happens to those hailstones, it's marvelous. I can collect that ice and put it in my drink and have a nice cool iced tea. Whatever happens. Now, it's not just a joke, because you can make use of anything in this life. As you know, my old story, and it's not just not complaining about anything, because, you know, rather light a candle. Life gives you lots of dog poo. Dog poo, that's right, what you step in sometimes on the way here. And dog poo is smelly, is offensive, it's very, you know, yucky, but it's great fertilizer. Whatever happens to you in life, the negative part is like stepping in dog poo. Sometimes it's not dog poo you step in, but elephant poo, because there's so much of it. But the more the better for your garden. When you grow a mango tree, that mango is sweet, is delicious. Why? Because of the dog poo. When you taste that mango, you're tasting dog poo, transformed into sweet, juicy mango. That's where it comes from. And you understand now the meaning of this simile. Global warming, or whether it's skin cancers coming from just the depletion of the ozone, the forest being sort of destroyed. We're going to try and stop those, yeah. But we can only do so much. But when it does happen, whatever happens, we can always use that fertilizer for our wisdom, for our compassion. Sometimes the people want the world to be a utopia. What a terrible world it would be if it was a utopia. People would not need to be kind with it to each other. They wouldn't need to care. There would be no need for compassion. There would be no need for love, for wisdom. If the world was perfect, what a terrible place this would be. It's wonderful to go to the hospitals and see those who are sick, and see the nurses looking after them so kindly, to see people visiting them, to see people actually looking after those who are needy and sick. Those who are sick are doing a great service to the world by allowing other people to be compassionate. Those who are sick in Buddhism, in Mahayana Buddhism, we call this a bodhisattva practice. You're giving up your happiness to encourage other people to understand Dhamma, to understand compassion and service and kindness. When there's poor people in this world, it encourages us to understand the meaning of generosity, to care. When there are orphans, people with no parents, with no one to love them, it teaches us how to appreciate not only our parents, but to look after those people. Because we know what it's like. If there was no suffering in this world, where would ever we find the wisdom to be compassionate? So whatever happens in this world, we can actually make use of this. Maybe the world becomes a mess, but the world outside is not so important. It's the world inside which is important. It's our kindness and our compassion, the spiritual qualities. That's the meaning of life. That's what life is all about. It's not what we have, but how we relate to it. It's not what occurs to us in life, but what we do with it. Rather light a candle to complain about darkness. There's always a candle there somewhere to light. So stop being a victim and do something about it. Learn from it. Grow from it. Become a wiser, kinder person as a result. When things go wrong, we can always learn. And sometimes those are our best lessons. The teachers I hated the most at school were the strict ones. I didn't like them, but those are the ones I learnt the most from. Now I think, thank you. Sometimes the lessons in life, the tough ones, the difficult ones. We lose a son, we lose a daughter. We have a separation in a relationship. We have a cancer, we have a death. We lose our money. Whatever it is happens to us in life. Aren't those great occasions for growth? For wisdom, for kindness, for understanding. Isn't that the time we really appreciate what life is truly like? Yesterday I had the privilege of going to a funeral service in Fremantle. At that service, everyone was listening to the talk. It's amazing how death sort of makes you pay attention. So everyone was really paying attention to what I was saying. And one of the things I was saying is that it happens every time at the end of a service, people start talking about the person who's dead. And they never, ever talk about how rich they were, how much money they had, how wonderful they were, how high they were in society. They always talk about how generous they were, how loving they were, how compassionate they were, how they looked after their friends and their relations, how they were always forgiving. Those are the qualities which you remember the dead by. You never remember the dead by their wealth, by their position in society, how big their house is or what type of car they said they drove. You never see on the headstones and gravestones, proud owner of a Mercedes. Because that doesn't count. That is not important. That's only temporary. The size of your house, the size of your car, the size of your bank balance doesn't count as much as the size of your heart. That is what people remember you by. That is the meaning of life. And so, okay, global warming, they may destroy all of our houses if we live too close to the beach. The oil prices may mean we can't have our big cars anymore. Just, I don't know what else happens in this world, but the forests, means that our air is not so good anymore. But we can still have compassion, kindness, generosity, the beautiful qualities. We can still be incredibly wealthy. Not in things, but in compassion and wisdom, kindness, love. And isn't that what the life is all about? So when I say global warming, I like the idea of global warming. I think global warming is a wonderful idea. The global warming of people's hearts. So people become more compassionate and kind in this world. That's what I call by global warming. Can we warm people's hearts to each other? Can we warm the hearts of the Israelis to the Palestinians? Can we warm the hearts of Al-Qaeda to Mr. Bush? Global warming. That's what I think we should do. And that way, when we have the warmth in the heart, the sort of rise in the sea level, great, rising the level of people's kindness and compassion towards each other, rising people's virtues, so we can flood the low lifes of this world. And that way, we actually can get something good in this world, and life can be better and happy. It doesn't matter how much you have. It doesn't matter if you destroy your cars and destroy the energy so you can't sort of come and go wherever you want. It doesn't matter if you can't have a television anymore. My goodness, what do you want those things for anyway? Isn't it more important that you have your family and friends? Many years ago, I should have got this somewhere from the internet or noted it from the time, but the London School of Economics did this amazing survey. Now, London School of Economics, a famous institution in London, part of the London University, one of the great centres of economics in the world. And they decided it's not really fair to judge a country by the gross national product because that misses out so much. So they decided to have another standard to measure a country's happiness, well-being. And with a whole group of students, they started to work out criteria to measure a country's well-being by, such as longevity of marriage would be a plus, divorces would be a negative, suicides would be a negative, your health, psychological problems would be a negative, whatever it was, to try and work out a person's happiness. Like wealth was only one thing, health was one thing. They had other things as well to work out what was a happy country. And then they applied that standard to so many countries in the world, and they came up with a surprising result. The country with the highest level of well-being turned out not to be the United States, not to be France or Italy or Greece or something, and certainly not Australia. The country which turned out to be the happiest and most well-being in the world was Bangladesh. one of the poorest countries was deemed to be one of the happiest. And that surprised everybody, even the Bangladeshis. Because they wanted more aid coming in. We don't want to sort of be looked upon as being happy. And one of the reasons was because they had such strong family ties. So that no one was ever alone. No one was ever lonely. If you lost your parents, you had so many aunts and uncles who would look after you. Because they had strong family ties, suicide was just never happened. At least at that time, anyway. And I still recall going to this village in northeast Thailand where I became a monk. 1974-75. That's 30 years ago now. And at that time, this was northeast Thailand, away from the cities, in the jungles, undeveloped. To get there was just over dirt roads, no electricity, no televisions. A village which hadn't changed for centuries. And I remember the first year there, going into a ceremony in one of the houses. As we were walking in the evening, using our flashlights, we passed house after house after house. And you looked up and saw the same sight. In the open balcony area, which formed most of the house, you'd see semicircles of faces illuminated by the flame of a simple oil lamp. And you looked at those faces. There were the old grandparents or uncles, the parents, the children, the brothers and sisters, usually about 13, 16, 20 people lived in the same house, sitting around as they would do every night of the year, talking to each other, telling stories, cracking jokes. Old jokes, old stories, but they still loved them. Every evening they'd be spent together, talking to one another. When I saw that, I realized what a deprived childhood I had had. I had a TV. Even though we only had one TV in the house, we had to watch it together. You wouldn't believe the arguments we had. We didn't talk with each other. We did talk with each other. It was always, I want that channel on. No, you had it last time. It's my turn now. No, it isn't. Remember those arguments when you used to have one TV in one house? There's only two channels. My goodness, I don't know what happened these days when there's six or seven. But that sight stayed with me all these years. It was a state of like family, of harmony, of peace, of love, of caring, of meeting together, of talking together, of being together. How much is that worth? Would you give that up for millions of dollars? You ask any of those people who were in that house at that time, they wouldn't give that up. That was worth so much more. There's something more to life than materialism. And when we talk about the future of our world, we're just talking about the future of materialism. The fact that maybe we won't be able to just afford big houses, big cars. Maybe we'll have to move. Maybe we have to, wouldn't it be wonderful, have to learn to live together because there might be so much land and use less. Maybe the time when we each have our own little room in a house will be gone. We have to actually share a room with somebody, with many people. And the kids will have to share. I grew up with my brother having to share the room all my life. Sure, we had arguments, but we learned to love each other and care for each other because you know, you slept in the same room with the fella. I remember my father saying, oh, let alone the same room, they had to share the same bed, six or seven kids. I don't know how they got to sleep, but they certainly learned how to love and care for each other for the rest of their life. Wouldn't it be wonderful if we all had to live in a small room? Then we'd have to get on with each other. So have global warming, this might go wrong, this might go wrong. But what might go right? Maybe ecological disaster will become so strong, it will mean people have to work together. We have to put away all of our armaments, and perhaps soldiers will have to actually change from fighting the world to fixing the world. Maybe that when things go terribly, terribly wrong, maybe we come to our senses and learn the most important things in life, and not just big houses and big cars and coming here and going there and measuring ourselves by our wealth, but measuring ourselves with the LSE's measurement of happiness factor. And that's something which ecological disaster, global disaster, will not alter, because that's part of the way we look at life. That's the way we react to life. That's the emotional world. That's what people talk about when you die. The important qualities. Trouble is that people are just so materialistic these days. They worry about the dollar going up, the dollar going down. They worry about the share market going up, the share market going down. I know that because a couple of Sundays we had this big ceremony in Supreme Court Garden for WASAC. And it's just, I looked up, there was the stock exchange building. And a big sort of the all odds industry going up, going down. Wouldn't it be wonderful just for one day of the week, WASAC, we can have like the happiness going up or going down. Or sort of like something spiritual, like peace on earth going up or going down. And having a building which shows that sign instead of just stupid stock markets and shares going up. What does that mean anyway, stock market? So when we actually start to see what is most important in the world, then natural disasters can't destroy that. Can a natural disaster destroy caring, love, working together, friendship, harmony, family bonds, generosity? You actually find when there are natural disasters, it actually works in the opposite direction. It actually brings communities together. What was it? Well, I think recently there was an earthquake in Turkey and the Greeks went to help. Or was it the other way around? Who cares which way around it was? But they were, you know, warring with each other for so long. And there's a natural disaster, okay, we'll come and give a hand. Or there was an earthquake in, what was it, Qom in Iran. And other Western countries came to help. Isn't that a wonderful signal which goes against, doesn't matter if you're an Islamic country or a Christian country or Buddhist country or whatever. Let's put aside those external signs of religion and go to the internal signs of spirituality. Somebody needs help and I can give it. That's all we need. Who cares whether you're a Buddhist, a Muslim, a Hindu, or who cares? You are someone who needs help. I want to help you. One of the most inspiring stories I heard of a couple of years ago, there was a Sri Lankan monk. Sometimes, I know you Sri Lankans are sort of not very happy about your monks, but there are some great monks in Sri Lanka, Sinhalese monks, and this was one of them. He was not just a blood donor, he was an organ donor as well. And they found there was one lady in Sri Lanka who needed a kidney transplant. She's on dialysis. They found out the only match in the whole of the island of Sri Lanka was this monk. The trouble was, that lady who needed a kidney was an evangelical Christian. And so they asked the monk, say, do you want to give your kidney to the opposition? Because that's what it's like sometimes. Some religions are like that. You know, we're the Christians, you're the Satan worshippers. You know, whatever it is they think you are. And of course, he just said, thank goodness he was a proper Buddhist. He said, of course, she needs a kidney. I don't care who she is. She can have my kidney. And so the monk went to the hospital and gave his kidney to someone who was converting all the Buddhists to Christianity. What a wonderful thing that was. And I admire people like that. It doesn't matter who they are. And if a West Coast Eagle wanted to donate a leg to a Fremantle Docker, it doesn't matter what side you're on. Someone needs it, so you give it. You know, I wrote a story in a little book which is coming out soon about a Buddhist football team. Imagine a Buddhist footy team. If the other team wanted the ball, you give it to them out of compassion. Here, take it. That's more important. If they couldn't score the goal themselves, say, look, here, this is how it's done. Kick it in your own goal. And you wouldn't be doing any of these rough tackles and that sort of stuff. You know, if you tackle, excuse me, sir, would you mind stopping a moment? and being very polite, passing the ball over, because not into violence, but into compassion. And also, if they really wanted the ball, you give it to them, because we're into letting go. Letting go. Here you are. If you want the ball. It doesn't matter if you come bottom of the league, because we know we're into humility. Humility. We sacrifice us for the sake of others. Isn't that what life is all about? Sacrificing your own happiness. So anyone else wants to win, oh, please, you win. And when you get relegated at the end of the season, that's what we're supposed to be. We're supposed to be relegated out of samsara. The end of samsara. We leave the whole league of suffering. So a Buddhist football team, I think, will be very, maybe won't win very much, but it'll be good fun. isn't that what life is all about? Being kind, giving, generous, warm-hearted. So when we start to think of those are something which global warming, ecological disaster, whatever else terrible things happen in your life, should never be able to destroy. Whether it's your husband leaving, your wife dying, your children not doing too well at school, one of your children coming out saying they're gay, should that really destroy your Buddhist qualities of kindness, compassion, love, forgiveness, warmth? It should not at all. It's the qualities which are important, the spiritual qualities which are important. We can always light a candle of wisdom, of love, of caring, no matter what happens. So don't complain, oh, you shouldn't have done that. Oh, my son shouldn't be a drug addict. Oh, my daughter shouldn't be gay. Oh, this shouldn't happen. Look, come on, light a candle of compassion, of wisdom and care. Isn't that the most wonderful thing we can do? And when we can do that, we can actually build a beautiful world. Okay, the forest can be destroyed, but we'll have beautiful people. And actually, you find we have beautiful people, the forest start regenerating again. You find when we have people who consume less, because they don't need so much to create happiness, they have each other for happiness. They don't need such a big house. They want to live together in small houses for friendship, for family ties, for caring with and seeing each other. I want to see my children. I want to see my wife, my husband. So let's just have one room to stay in instead of a family room, which no one ever goes in. Sort of a front room, a back room, a games room, a toilet. How many toilets you got in your house? You can only use, how many people are in there to use them, my goodness? You spend most of the time cleaning your house, not using it. So wouldn't it be wonderful? We don't need that much. When we don't need that much, it doesn't matter about, you know, the economy going down. The economy may go down, but people's hearts may go up. When we stop looking at things like, I remember during the Second World War, my parents telling me, that was a terrible time. In London, there was bombs being dropped. My mother told me that she was in one of these terrace houses in London, in the borough of Acton, and a bomb landed next door. Their neighbours got completely blown to smithereens. And she was very lucky to come out. She just had sort of no wounds along her arm, just blood pouring out. They said that was one of the best times for people in London. They really worked together. And people actually say, I think some of the American reporters were there at the time, say they're just so impressed how Londoners coped with the Blitz, with people dying around them, bombs going off, rationing. In that so-called disaster, those other things grew in the place of life and health. What grew was like working together, friendship, caring for each other, family values, kind values, looking after each other, generosity. All those things we call spiritual values were important at that time. So those of you who look for terrible things happening in the world in the future, perhaps they're not so terrible after all, even if they do happen. Maybe they won't happen. Who knows what happens? I can't predict the future. What I can predict, if people are good people, then good things happen to them. Doesn't matter what's happening outside. They may destroy our monastery. They can never destroy a monk's beautiful heart. They can never destroy people's working together, forgiveness, generosity, gratitude. That can never be destroyed. unless you allow it to be taken away. My favorite saying, I never allow anybody else to control my happiness. You can call me whatever you like. You can say this is the best talk you've ever heard or the most stupid talk you've ever heard. I will not allow anything to control my happiness. My happiness is my business. So why would you allow disasters in the world to upset you, to control your happiness? It's an interesting idea, isn't it? Sometimes we look at things in the newspaper or in the TV and we get very sad and upset. Does that help? I'm not saying happiness means you don't care. Happiness means you care enormously. As I said in the funeral service, the last simile, I'm not sure when the last said this, Ajahn Chah would often hold up a glass like this and say, can you see the crack in the glass? We didn't know what he was talking about. Oh, I can't see any crack. He says, there's a crack there. It's only infinitesimal. It's growing every day. And one day it will grow so much that the glass will crack and will no longer be able to be used. He said, this is a body. This is a world. This is life. Our life is always impermanent. It's cracking. We are cracking. Some people are more cracked than others. It's about to crack, you know, about to die. Things are about to go wrong. You know, the global warming's about to happen. War's going to happen. What's going to happen? It's all cracked. It's fragile. It's about to end. But the beautiful thing, as Ajahn said, because it's fragile, because it's got a crack in it, because one day this glass will shatter, that's its destiny, therefore I care about this glass. Therefore I put it down gently. Therefore I don't knock it and hurt it, because I know this glass won't last very long. You are like this glass. You've got a crack in you. One day that crack will open up and you will die. Because you are impermanent, fragile, that is why you care. Your loved ones will one day leave you. Your relationship has a crack in it. One day your relationship will shatter and die. Because of that, that is why you care. If this glass was made of some material which was completely indestructible, why would I need to care about it? I could throw it around, drop it, who cares, it's indestructible. If it was permanent, there would be no need for compassion, for care. Because our children one day won't be here, that's why we care for them. Because one day Ajahn Brahm won't be here, you better care for me. And because our environment, it's got a crack in it, we have to care for our environment. But we know that one day, the nature of things is to cease to fall apart. What rises must one day pass away. What gets born must one day die. What comes together, your loved ones, one must one day part. That's obvious, that's the law of nature. But it doesn't make life gloomy. It makes life compassionate. Because this is all going to end. That is why I care. So life is not gloomy after all. It's not doomsday, but compassion day. It's not sort of Armageddon, but Carmageddon. It's how we can make lots and lots of good karma to make this world happy. The spiritual values can never be destroyed, except if you destroy them. Kindness, generosity, gratitude, love, peace. Global warming, ecological disaster, can't destroy that. And that is the most important thing. So, that's the talk. I'm not about doomsday, but, what did I say? Carmageddon Day, yes. Okay, so thanks for listening to the talk, and I hope the person in the United States appreciates this talk. And he was worrying about having children. So if you want to have children, they'll be fine. You'll be able to. There's lots of good things happening in the world. And if they got good karma, then they'll be happy in this world. Create good spiritual qualities. What happens outside is not important, as long as we create those beautiful spiritual qualities inside. And then we're impervious. The heart will be able to survive, no matter what happens to the body. Thank you very much. Hope you enjoyed the talk.